Okay, today is December 16th, 2013. This is Fidencio Marbella with the Westchester Public Library in Westchester, Illinois. Also present is Patrick Callahan, a reference librarian here at the library. Today we will be speaking with Mr. Charles Lewis Barra. Charles served in the United States Marine Corps Reserves for about 2 years. And this interview is being conducted for the Veterans History Project at the Library of Congress. Okay, let's go ahead and get started, Chuck. Why don't you tell us when and where you were born and a little bit about your family when you were growing up.
I was born in Chicago, Illinois, so I've stayed pretty much close to home my whole life. I grew up first in the western part of Chicago, and then we moved first to Cicero and then to Westchester.
Okay.
So basically followed Cermak Road just west.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I went to St. Francis of Rome Grammar School, St. Joseph's High School, Western Illinois University down in Macomb, Illinois.
Okay. Before we started this interview, you spoke quite a bit about your father.
Yes.
So obviously you have a tradition of service within
yes.
your family. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your father's service in the
okay.
U.S. Navy?
My father was born in Murfreesboro, Illinois, down in southern Illinois, and in 1936 he joined the Navy. Again, being from a small, I mean, back in 36 it was still the Depression. Coming from a small town, that was a big step to get out of Murfreesboro and go out and see the world. So he joined the Navy in 36, and after he graduated from Great Lakes, he went on the USS Chicago, which at the time was one of the premier cruisers in the fleet.
Okay. I have to ask you this. Did he get to pick that ship?
I'm not sure. I don't know the answer to that. And then, from 36 up until the beginning of the war, he was on the Chicago. They were basically, from my understanding, in the Pacific. They went to San Diego, Seattle, and Honolulu, basically, and then all around. So they had gone various places. I know he went to Australia and New Zealand and New Guinea and stuff like that on the ship. And obviously he crossed the equator because I have that thing there. And then he says he was in Hawaii, and then, of course, in California. And then in 1941 or 42, at the beginning of the war, he transferred off the Chicago and went into the amphibious forces, and he talks about being in New York and then being shipped to England. And then he went on the invasion of North Africa in the amphibious, with the amphibious force. He said, as an electrician, they were trying to take the harbor. So they had so they had Navy people there who, when they went in, they would, secure the harbor and then open up the harbor and get ships in there. So he was, as an electrician, and he was in the combat engineers. He was part of the group that was supposed to go in there and secure the harbor. Well, he tells stories that it went wrong. The invasion, he used to get very, very angry. He said, oh yeah, Mark Clark was supposed to have gone over there and got everything all worked out. He says, and he used more colorful language, but that didn't really work. I guess they put a chain across the harbor and the boat sank and stuff like that. Well, anyway, he got captured, and he was captured by the Vichy French, and he didn't like the French. He said that when they marched him through the streets, they spit at him and stuff like that. And he sustained an injury. I guess he was somehow on a half track or something like that, and he got blown off of it and hurt his back. But then ultimately he got, as the invasion progressed, they got liberated, or he got freed. And then he was assigned to the harbor at Oran, Algeria. So he was in Oran for most of the war, or a lot of the war, and he was doing the operational stuff there. I mean, being an electrician and stuff like that. Funny story. He ran into a guy that he knew from Oran years ago, again, here in Chicago. Because, like I said, back then, there was a lot of guys with previous service. It was a very fraternal kind of thing. You'd go to American Legion, and there'd be hundreds of guys at the American Legion because they'd all served in World War II. So as a kid growing up, those American Legion picnics, God, it was like Taste of Chicago. I mean, it was unbelievable. So he ran into a guy that he knew from Oran, and he was a salesman. And so we had gone out to dinner with him and stuff like that. And the guy gave me a dictionary, in fact. But anyway, they were talking, and he told a story about how they were all amazed because my dad had wired the big freezers for the base with telephone wire. And he says, it's amazing none of that stuff burnt down because he had big freezer motors running on telephone wire. But again, that was during the war in Iran. I guess they didn't have enough wire, and he wired the freezers with telephone wire.
Yeah, you do what you got to do.
Yeah, and so that was kind of a funny story. But then he left the Navy in 1946, and then we lived in Chicago, married my mother, you know, and then we came here, and then that's how it started.
Okay. So obviously, you know, you do have that tradition in your family.
Yes.
Of serving our country. What made you decide to join the Marine Corps Reserves?
Two things. First, I had always wanted to be a pilot. And as you look, you know, back in the 70s, you know, they had, you know, Navy and Army, you know, aviation programs. But the Marines had what I considered to be the best option if you were going to be a pilot. At least they had the shortest service requirement after you had flight training and after you were commissioned. I think it was only like 4 years, whereas the Navy would have required six and the Air Force much more. The Navy and the Air Force were much harder to get into. And I didn't even make it in the Marine Corps. I didn't get to aviation training. And, you know, just it was a better deal. And the second part of it was everybody, or at least growing up, you know, the image of the Marine Corps is that they're the toughest outfit. And quite honestly, I wanted to see if I was tough enough to be a Marine. I wanted I wanted to challenge myself, and I guess, you know, am I good enough or am I tough enough to be a Marine?
Now, what year was this that you
enlisted? I enlisted, it was the end of 1971, basically the beginning of 72. What honestly, got a true story. I had always, you know, had in the back of my mind, you know, that I wanted to be a Marine. My father, being in the Navy, never liked the Marine Corps. That was not one of his favorite decisions. But he didn't, you know, my dad, you know, would let me do what I want. But I mean, you know, I could tell he didn't like the Marine Corps.
Did he try and talk you into joining the Navy?
He didn't say anything one way or the other. He told me clearly about his experience. You know, he always said, it's your decision, it's your life. Do what, you know, you have to live your life your way. Don't live your life for me or following me or something like that. He says, it's your life. Live it. He told me about the Navy. One thing he always said, he said, if you're going to go in as an officer, not an enlisted man. You'll live. It's a better deal as an officer than as an enlisted man. So if you're going to do that. I said, don't just run away and join the service right after high school. Go to college and get a commission and go in as an officer. It'll be much better than if you go in as an enlisted man. He says, I went in as an enlisted man because I had no other options. He says, I was hungry. You know, they fed us, you know, three meals a day in the Navy. You know, and that's one of the reasons why he went in. But he said, if you have the chance and you really want to go in as an officer. So I went to college, and I was looking at ROTC and stuff like that. But then the Marine Corps was always in the back of my mind. I was looking in the student newspaper one day down in Macomb, and there was at that time the service in the early 70s was just changing over from the draft and the lottery and all that in the post-Vietnam era. They were just starting to go into the recruiting, the volunteer service. They were just starting to beginning to recruit, but there was still a lot of sentiment on colleges against the military. I mean, the post-Vietnam dislike of the military, the Vietnam, didn't go away. I mean, it went all the way into the 70s. So on one hand, the military was there trying to recruit, and on the other hand, there were still people throwing stuff at them and carrying signs and saying, we don't want you here, and baby killers and warmongers and stuff like that. So there was still tension. So the first, when the Marines first came there, was their officer recruiters. They would set up tables in the lobby and, you know, have their signs up and stuff like that. Well, the first day they had some trouble, so they didn't set up the table out in the conspicuous part of the lobby. They had a room way in the back or something like that, kind of out of the way. Well, I had looked on the schedule of the of the events, and I saw that they were going to be there. So I was going to go there the first day, and you know that was my first step in joining. You know, you have to go there. You talk to somebody called an officer selection officer, an OSO. So you go there and you talk to the OSO, and then they interview you. You take some they do the processing. So I went there, and the table wasn't there. So I looked on the board, the board, and I see they're back in the room. So I go back to the room, and I go back, and they were really out of the way back there. And I knock on the door, and I walk in, and it's just them there. They're sitting there. I said hi, and I introduced myself, and I met the his name was Morrison, and I talked to him. I said, yeah, I'm interested in the PLC program. He goes, God, that's amazing that you found us. We're not even out in the lobby yet. He says, you must really be interested. And I go, yeah. And that's the way it started. I found them in the back room. And then, of course, you have to take, tests and interviews and stuff. It's a pretty rigorous process. I mean, they do look pretty closely. And then that's how it started. And then I was a junior. At the time, the Marine Corps had, in their PLC program, there were two options. You could go 2 6-week periods if you were like a sophomore and a junior, and then basically you get your commission when you graduate. Or if you are already a junior, you go for 10 weeks for the summer between your junior and senior year. So it's 2 6-weeks if you're younger, but if you're a junior, you go for 1 10-week in between your junior and senior, and you get commissioned when you graduate.
What did the PLC stand for?
Platoon Leaders Class.
Okay.
So basically, I was a junior, so I signed up for that 10-week, it was 1972, that 10-week stretch, the 10-week OCS class in Quantico, Virginia. So then, like I said, I wanted to be a pilot. Well, unfortunately, my aviation aptitude isn't all that good. So I flunked the aviation aptitude.
So they tested you for that?
Yeah.
What kind of, do you remember?
There was a lot. I remember they asked questions to the effect of, when was the first time you ever changed a tire? When do you use tools? They had those little pictures where they have the sky, and they say, okay, if you're this way, which way's up?
Okay.
and stuff like that. And I go, how do I know which way's up? but there was a series of tests like that. And I did not do well on it. Even having done that, I still wanted to see how tough I was. I still wanted to see if I could cut it, which, looking back now is kind of risky. Because when I graduated. So I successfully did it. But, a lot of guys didn't. The washout rate at OCS in the Marine Corps, very high. It's 30-40%. They tell you it's 30, half the guy, a good solid third of the guys don't make it, either by discharge on request, they call it DOR, or they ask you to leave. I mean, it's very physical, very mentally demanding. Not so much that they're throwing trigonometry at you or something like that, but they put you under intense pressure. I mean, they rattle your cage from the time you get off the bus to the time you get back on the bus. I mean, they're continuously putting pressure on you to see how you're... Their philosophy was, if they can break you in training, you'll break in combat. And so they're cranking on you all the time. And that's what they do. And if you can do it and you graduate, it's a tremendous feeling. But a lot of guys didn't. And, I knew some of those guys I knew. In fact, one of them was from Western. And, he really wanted... In fact, I knew two guys. One guy was... And I'm not going to mention these names. But one guy was very, very good. And he got caught shoplifting. I mean, he was a much better officer candidate than I ever was. I mean, the Marine Corps has a very high moral, ethical code. He ripped off a CD tape, and he lost his commission. I mean, they discharged him. I mean, no way. I mean, in the Marine Corps, if you don't project the image that they want, I mean, and they're very big on integrity. Very big on integrity, moral conduct, and stuff like that. I mean, he got caught shoplifting; he was gone, and he was a good guy. There was another guy I know. He just wasn't that physical. I mean, he just couldn't keep up. I mean, there was a lot of guys there that they had a good heart, but they didn't have the body. And that body, you know, they talk about it being tough. It is tough. I mean, I was an athlete my whole life. You know, I'm not Mr. Super Poster Marine as you look at me, but you know, I can work out. You know, I can run, I can climb, stuff like that. A lot of it is the mental side of it too. So if you can do it and you graduate, it's a tremendous feeling. But a lot of these guys wanted to, but they couldn't. And that's just, you know, I don't know what it would be like going through life with that kind of failure or having that kind of, oh, yeah, I couldn't do it. You know, if you do it, and then, you know, like me, I resigned to go to grad school and stuff like that. Okay, I made a decision, you know, right or wrong, good or bad. But it was my decision. It wasn't really forced on me. Somebody who really wanted it and flunked. You know, that kind of failure is kind of hard to live with. And I wouldn't, you know, that's why I say it's risky. It's a tremendous risk. I don't know what it would be like to carry that, you know, all, you know, your whole life, knowing that, you know, okay, yeah, but I'm just not good enough for that. I'm really that kind of screw up, you know, and just kind of, you know, have your head down, and you can make bad decisions. And you say, okay, and you can almost laugh about it, but to have a failure like that, you know, that really eats at you. So that's why I say it was kind of risky, but I did it, and I got through it, and I'll tell you. On graduation day, when we walked down that parade ground, you know, flags flying, you know, music playing and stuff like that, it was the most exhilarating feeling of my life because I knew I had accomplished, I went through one of the toughest military programs in the world. I did it. I got through it. And it was just, I can't tell you how great that feeling. I mean, it's one of the highlights of my life, even now. And that was 1972, and it still, you know, gives me, you know, I get excited. That's just the way it is. And so it was great like that. But the risk, if you couldn't do it, would have been just as devastating, I think.
Well, it's a great motivating factor for you not to fail.
Yeah. Well, you almost... I'll tell you a funny story. You guys like story. I'll tell you a story. We have time for this, though.
Absolutely.
Okay. When we first, you know, when you go to OCS, you know, you get grouped in with people and stuff like that, and you fly on something called a group ticket. So you don't get an individual thing. You meet a bunch of guys at the airport, and you have a group, and like, there's 10 of you on the same ticket, and you all go as a group. Well, obviously, you know, the Chicago OSO, you know, officer selection officer, Chicago OSO put his 10 guys going to Virginia, you know, on the same plane. You're all on the same plane and stuff like that. So one guy had the ticket, and the other 9, 10 of us or whatever. We fly into D.C., and they have an officer meet you at the gate, you know, to take you to the bus and stuff like that. So the guy there, you know, says, oh, well, who's in charge here? And, you know, all of us, I've never seen each other. We look around, I don't know who's in charge. Well, there was a guy there, and he was, I mean, this guy looked like a Marine. He was big. I'm 5'7". This guy was about 6'2", you know, and stuff. And I'll never forget, he had a fraternity shirt on. He was from the University of Illinois. And I had fraternity shirt on and stuff like that. And he looked the part and he goes, well, I guess I'm in charge. You know. And I looked, I go, yeah, that's a pretty good decision. You look like a Marine, you know, and stuff like that. And so he had the stuff and he'd take him in there. And so we get on the bus and, you know, you go through that gate at Quantico. And that's the last peace and quiet you have for 10 weeks. They start shouting from the time you get off the bus to the time you get back on. I mean, I've never heard human beings shout like that. I mean, the first night, our two sergeant instructors, they shouted continuously for 4 hours, nonstop. I didn't think human vocal cords could do that. I've never heard two people shout like that before. I mean, it's unbelievable. So anyway, so they're shouting. Well, anyway, they break you up into platoons and companies and stuff like that. And I think that... I don't know if they had a method to what they were doing. I'm sure they did, but it seemed random to us. You know, you're running around. It's night. You know, you don't sleep. The first night you get there, you don't sleep. I mean, they give you like 2 hours sleep or something like that. So you're tired. You know, not only are they shouting, you're tired. I mean, because you ain't sleeping. So, you know, they go through like. So anyway, we go through there, and then, you know, the training starts. And they start. Well, anyway, the Chicago group, we were basically in the same company. So... You know, you have four platoons in a company and stuff like that at the time. So, you know, you see him. I mean, I wasn't right next to the guy, but I saw him around and stuff. Well, so the training starts. And part of what Marines do is Marines march a lot. You know, that they you put your pack and your rifle on and you go and they run you. And part of that training, part of those marches is they see who drops. So in other words, part of it is they, you know, you gotta keep up. And it's designed, you know, a lot of the guys fall out, you know. Well, it was one of those days. 72, there was a lot of rain in Virginia. It was rainy, and it was muddy, and it was, you know, there's a stretch of land that starts at Washington and runs all the way through St. Louis. You know, that whole stretch of the middle part of the country there, you get into July and August, it's humid and 100 degrees. I mean, it starts at Washington, goes all the way through Cincinnati, goes all the way through St. Louis, and it's just hot there. You get down there in July, and it's hot and it's humid. And it's just that stretch of the middle of the country. I mean, at least I know it's there. And, well, it was, Quantico's just a little bit south of Washington, and it's hot and it's humid. Well, it's one of these days, it's muddy, and it's hot. And we're on that trail, and we're carrying the full marching packs and the rifle and the helmet and you're struggling to keep up. And a lot of guys are falling out. And there's this guy who 5 weeks ago was in his fraternity shirt, and he's in charge, Mr. Marine. I'll never forget this. He's on the side of the trail. He has tears coming down his eyes. He says, "I can't do this. I want to go home. I want to go home." And he said, and as I went past, I kind of looked out and I looked at the, and I said, "That's the guy who 5 weeks ago I was in the airport following because he was the Marine, and he, you know, he was in charge." And you know, so it's that kind. So a lot of times, you know, you have trouble making up, you know, keeping up. But a lot of times, you just, you know, the mental, you know, and that's the mental side of it. Now that's, again, that's not trigonometry or calculus or something like that. That's just mentally, you know, am I going to make it to the end of this trail? Am I going to go up that hill? You know, am I going to, you know, do what they want me to do? For myself personally, I don't know how they figured this stuff out. I'm not the most gifted person when it comes to heights. You know, I'm not exactly Mr. Graceful. I don't like heights. I don't know how they did this, but every time there was something with heights, I was the first thing Barra go to. You know, I'm there. I go, how do they keep picking me? I mean, I never told them I was afraid of heights. I don't like snakes, all that stuff. I was the guy that got the snake thrown on my chest. I'll never forget that. I'm going under the barbed wire. You know, you crawl. When you go under barbed wire, at least the cow fence, you go on your back, you put the rifle up, and you crawl under like that. I'm just under the wire. They threw the snake on my, there's a snake on my chest. I'll never forget this. It was a green snake. It had black eyes and a pink tongue. And we looked, I had eye recognition with the snake. Because, you know, I couldn't move. You know, I'm there and there's a snake and it's looking right at me. And I looked at it and it looked at me. It stuck its tongue out. Then it crawled out. You know, how did they know that I don't like snakes? I don't know how they knew that, but I got the snake on my chest. Well, anyway, so height. I don't like heights. Well, I guess they saw that when there's an obstacle on the obstacle course. It's called the composite. You climb up a rope, you go to the top, you jump off the rope, and you go down a big long log, you know, down the log. Well, I'm not the most graceful person coming down the log. I get down the log. There's my platoon sergeant right there. And I'll never forget. His name was Vaughn. Very, very good guy. Vaughn's standing there with his hands on his hip. He saw me come down the log. He said, "Barra, do it again." So I go back and I go do it and come down again. He goes, "Barra, we're going to keep doing this until you come down that log like a Marine. Go back and do it again." Well, so then after about three times, I'm there and I said, well, I get to the point where I don't care if I break my leg. I don't care if I fall off this. He's going to stand there and keep making me do this forever, so I might as well do it. So after about the third or fourth time, I just come down that log, I run down that log, you know, I don't care if I fall off, I don't care. I said, at least if I go to sick bay and break my leg, I won't have him hollering at me anymore. So I dandy, and just walked away. But that's almost the mindset you have to have.
So that was his point.
That was his point. You do it. And, you know, if you break your leg or you fall off or whatever, but, you know, you do it. And that's what you have to have. And when you're on the trail, I mean, they said, you know, one of the lessons I learned, you ask what you learned. I'm telling stories about, you know, the hardship, but I learned so much. It's such a educational experience. you do different jobs there. So when they're training you to be an officer, they're training you to be a leader. One of the things they told it, which is very, very true, we were there, and we're obviously going up the hill, and you say, okay, come on, guys, one more step, and blah, 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 all that stuff. One of the things, he pulled me and says, Barra, when you're leading your platoon or you're motivating, you don't motivate them just to the top of the hill. Because what happens if you get to the top of the hill and you have to go further beyond that? You motivate somebody in such a way that you just don't motivate them to a certain point, because then if they have to go beyond that point, it's a letdown. You motivate them in such a way that you keep going, and then you go beyond that point if you have to. He said, but you don't just take somebody from there to there, because if you get there and you have to go further, you'll have a letdown. You know, that's an invaluable piece of information, and that's not just when you're going up a hill in Quantico, Virginia. That's in life. I mean, that's in business. That's in sports. That's all the way across the board. And you know, he told me that, and ankle deep in mud in Quantico, Virginia. But I mean, that's a life lesson that you learn or that you carry with you if you can. That's invaluable. I mean, they teach it to you in a rather harsh environment, but I mean that stuff is golden.
But it's obviously stuck with you.
Oh yeah. Oh. When you can't go through OCS half-assed. I mean, you got to put it all on the line, and let the chips fall where they may. And again, that goes back to the risky part. If you do that and you pass, that's great. If you put it all on the line and you fail, that's that part where you're motivating yourself to the top of the hill, and all of a sudden you get there and you got to, that's the letdown. And I think it's very, very, again, it's very emotionally risky to take that kind of risk. But if you take it and it's successful and you do it and you really put, it's such a tremendous feeling. It's worth the risk. It's worth the risk. There was one guy there. There's a couple. I'll never forget this. I guess a lot of the officer selection offices were trying to fill a quota. So there was a lot of guys that were there. There were a lot of guys that were there. There were a couple of guys there that, even you could tell that they didn't belong there. They were just, for some reason, they were just there. There was one guy there in our platoon. He couldn't even do 3 pull-ups. I mean, he was tall and skinny and stuff like that. I mean, I guess maybe he wanted to be. They got him aside. They were yelling. They yell at you all the time. And they just looked at him. What did you expect to do here all summer? Read? that's kind of funny. So, but yeah, you do have to do some pull-ups. You do have to do some running and stuff like that. But by the same token, that you also learn a lot of stuff. I mean, everything from leadership to, obviously, how to take apart a rifle and stuff like that. But also just about yourself and interacting with other people. That group dynamic or just management, for lack of a better word. Well, tremendous.
Now, how did it make you feel when you saw these men who you felt were bigger than you, tougher than you, dropping out?
A lot of them. I looked at that and I said, well, my God, maybe I am tough enough to do this. Maybe I can. And I'll be honest with you, one of the problems I have always had is self-confidence. And, now I'll tell you a very, very funny story. And this is the honest to God truth. The first night there when they really start, they're cranking and all that, at some point they kind of go good cop, bad cop on you. So what they have is they have the enlisted sergeant instructor yelling for hours on end. And then you go in and see the commanding officer. And he comes, come on, just relax and tell me how you feel. How was the trip in? So it's kind of like the good cop, the bad cop. Well, I slipped and I let my guard down. So I go in there and I'm talking to him, and I quite honestly told him, I said, geez, they've been yelling for the last 4 hours. I haven't had any sleep. I don't even know if I really want to do this. I said, but boy, this is hard. This is, I didn't expect them to yell like this, and I didn't expect all of this, And he goes, well, it's part of the training. He starts talking to me. So I figure, okay, fine. He was a nice guy and stuff like that. So I walked out. Well, then that was like the third night. Then over the next, 9 weeks, I mean, they're on me like a dirty shirt. I have this guy in my ear yelling. I mean, nothing I do is right. And in fact, they intentionally tried to mess me up. I mean, they would relieve me of command when I had the student billets and stuff like that. I mean, they intentionally. And then it got to the point where I'm thinking, well, geez, it doesn't make any difference what I do. They're gonna yell anyway. So what the hell? I might as well do what I want. But I'm thinking, why? I mean, clearly they were out of all the other 50 guys that were there. They were coming at me the hardest, and I could see it. And I'm thinking to myself, why? I haven't done anything. I said, I'm doing all right. So one night, I'm on the fire watch. You know, fire watch is one of those things they have in the Marine Corps where somebody's always, it's kind of like a sentry. Somebody's always awake, and that because of the nautical tradition where they used to have candles on ships and stuff like that, they were afraid of the fire. Okay. They call it the fire watch. So I was the fire watch one night. So I figured, I'm curious. So I go into the, it's middle of the night. Nobody's awake except me because I'm fire watch. So I go in there and I pull my file. I'm reading my file. What are they saying about me? I look. The first interview that third night, the officer wrote, questionable motivation, not sure whether he wants to be here, should be tested. And then I look. The first night when he went with that good cop, bad cop, and I let my guard down for couple of minutes, I told him, I said, hey, they've been yelling for 5 hours or whatever, and I'm not sure, I haven't slept. And he wrote that down, questionable motivation, not sure, we should test him, see how bad he wants to. And they kept yelling, Barra, how bad do you want to be here? Barra, how bad do you want to be here? Barra, you're going to quit? You're going to quit? And then finally, one time, I just told him, I said, hey, we just had the lottery. My number's 243. I'm here because I want to be here, not because I'm going to get drafted. Because back then what they had was that was the first years they had the lottery. What they put everybody's birthday in the fishbowl and pulled it out, and they drafted from 1 all the way down to 365. Well, I don't think they ever drafted past about 150. I don't know the exact number, but they didn't go all the way down to 365. They filled their what they needed at about 150, 160, somewhere around in there. I was 243. I said, hey, I am a volunteer. I said, really. I said, I'm not here because I'm afraid of being drafted in the Army or something like that. But that was it. So, they had, they cranked on me for 9 weeks. I wanted to see how tough I was. Well, I found out.
What other kinds of training did you have to go through besides just the physical aspect?
When you get there, they go through a lot of classroom stuff too. So a lot of it is obviously the physical. A lot of it is what they call leadership training. So you do everything from practicing leadership you start off, everybody rotates through a billet. They call them billets, like a job. So everybody's a platoon commander, a squad leader, fire team leader, and stuff like that. And what they do is, they let the students run, or they let the candidates run the company or run the problems, and they just watch. So in other words, you're kind of doing it, but they're yelling at you, and they're supervising you. They're setting the stage, and then you have to act out on the stage what they want. So you do that. They have a lot of classroom stuff where you learn everything from land navigation, how to read it. Funny story, back then we were still using maps and compasses. Now they use. I was
no GPS.
No GPS. No, we had
Garmin.
I know how to orient a. They had a thing called orienteering. That was one of the things they do. That's where you get a compass and you run through the woods and go from point to point and stuff like that. Marines were very big on that. So they had that, and obviously the rifle and stuff like that, and bayonet fighting, all that stuff. But they had everything from military law to the uniforms, stuff like that, and then of course. Just individually, we had to give speeches, write autobiographies, stuff like that. We had to get up there and we had to do impromptu talks. You talk about a speech class. Well, they had their own kind of little speech class there. You had to get up and they'd look through your biography and they'd pick a point, pick out something, and then you'd have to go up and give a 10-minute talk on that point. So I had put down in my biography that one of my summer jobs, I was a landscaper. So I had to give a 10-minute talk about how to plant a tree. or a shrub. I had to plant a shrub. There was a guy there who was a door-to-door salesman, the guy from Detroit, never forget. He was one of the funniest guys, and he used to sell stuff. He was a salesman. So they had to go, he had to give a 10-minute talk on selling stuff. I mean, there were, so anybody, if somebody said they were a scuba diver, they had to give a 10-minute talk on scuba diving. They said it was a judo player, they had to do, I didn't tell them any of that stuff. See, I had done all that. I was already judo and scuba diver and stuff like that. But I didn't put it, I wanted to go through as inconspicuously as possible. So I didn't put any of that. The only thing I put, I was a landscaper. So I gave the talk on planting a shrub. So various stuff like that all the way through. So it wasn't just doing pull-ups and sit-ups. There were other things in there too. So the guy that gave the talk on the salesman, the guy from Detroit, the commanding officer even said, he says, you're one of those rare people that can make people laugh. You have the gift to make people laugh. And he was just a really cool guy. So it was a combination of a lot of things like that.
Got to ask you, how do you train with bayonets without hurting each other?
Well, honest to God, true story. It's something called a pugil stick. It looks like a curtain rod, but it has two things on the end. One end's like where the bayonet is, and the other end's like the
butt.
Okay, funny story. My platoon sergeant, before he went to OCS, he was the head hand-to-hand combat instructor at Camp Pendleton. Only the best guys, only the best officers and the best sergeants get to be at OCS. I mean, that's every one of them had that airborne, wings on there. They were all recon. The guys that were there, at least when I was there, they were the cream of the cream of the non-commissioned officer crop of the Marine Corps. So they're there. So first day, we go out there, and you have a book, they show you, and then you go, but you have the pugil sticks. See, the weird thing about the pugil sticks is that's the one area that's totally the purview of the enlisted men. So in other words, officers carry pistols, and the sergeants, they would say, yeah, good enlisted men will take all these officer candidates. There was the right between. They'd always say, don't call me sir, I work for a living. stuff like that. So the sergeants are all there, and Vaughn is there, and he was the head hand to hand. So we go out there and they call me. Well, again, I'm not the biggest guy in the world. And, even though I was athletic, so I had never had one of these sticks before. I mean, they show. So you go out there and what they do is you put on a helmet and stuff like that. And then you square off with somebody. They blow the whistle and you just try to beat the heck out of each other. Well, the guy was a little bit bigger than me, obviously. Well, for some reason, the damn stick slipped out of my hand. I went like that, so there he is. He's coming. So I couldn't think of what else to do, so I kicked him in the shins. So I, boom, just kicked him in the shins like that. Then he took the stick like a baseball bat and hit me in the side of the head. like that. Well, then they stopped it. So, I go, my head was buzzing. So we go back there. And then, but in the background, you hear them, and then the other guys are starting to rib my platoon sergeant. The other sergeant, oh, Vaughn, what are you developing? A new system to fight? Maybe we just go out and kick the enemy in the shins. like that. Because they started riding him, the other guys, because it's kind of like a game for them. So we get back to the squad bay. And we're getting there, and all of a sudden I hear, Candidate Barra, report to the platoon sergeant. Candidate Barra, report to the platoon sergeant. So, oh, shit. Nothing ever good happens when you go. So I go in there and I report, and I never forget what he said. He goes, Barra, you embarrassed me in front of God and the platoon commander. What happened out there? I slipped. What do you mean, what happened? He slipped. He goes, well, you're not going to slip again. So I got private lessons. He said, you're not going to embarrass me. That's not going to happen again. You're not going to embarrass me again. So, he shows me how to do it, basically. I go out there. I go out there, fall out with him, and he just explains all this stuff. The trick is you go right for the jugular right away, and you come right there. But anyway, so couple weeks later, we go out there again. And again, you know, I don't know that they're playing games with me. So I'm getting ready to go. All of a sudden, okay, you guys know what Okies are, right? I mean, there was a lot of hard note. This Okie, I mean, thick forehead, no neck, big slobbering down the side of his mouth. He's coming up. He runs up. You know, what you do is you fight against other platoons. So our platoon was kind of in a contest with the other platoon, and he's going one-on-one with the sticks. This guy runs up in front of me, and they were still putting the helmet on me. You have a thing that cover your groin area, too, so they're still putting that stuff. He runs up there, and he's got that, and he's like, I'm going to kill you, I'm going to kill you. This is an old, I mean, like this. I'm going to kill you, I'm going to kill you. And I looked at him, and I think, why the hell are you yelling at me like that? I said, why are you yelling at me? I said, we got to go out there and do that. And I'm thinking, why is he coming at me that hard? And, you know, why is he trying to rattle my cage? You know, it's just another guy. And then I look over, and I see, because they have different referees, all of a sudden I see Vaughn come over and become the referee now. I go, aha, this is a test. This is the test. Now, that was very, then I realized, I said, oh, boy, he wants to see how his lessons have paid off. So then I'm thinking, okay, the first thing you did, vertical butts, you know, vertical slash, and butts, you know, stuff like that. So basically, I got the guy to a draw. You know, we did it three times and stuff like it. We got to the draw, and I did okay, and then went back like it. But that's the kind of, that's how you train with a bayonet and with a pugil stick. Basically, if anybody ever comes at you, but the first one's like that, and the second one's like that. But you know, they got the guy, and that didn't just happen. I mean, they set that up. They matched me up with that big Okie. I mean, that wasn't just the luck of the draw. I mean, now I look back, that was a setup. I mean, they wanted to see, you know, if I'd fold. There was no question about that.
And you didn't fold.
And I didn't fold, no. And I remember exactly, you coming right at the jugular right away. But that's how you do it. But I'll never embarrass you. You embarrass me in front of God and the platoon commander. I'm sorry. But now here was a guy, very, very, you know, you laugh about the sergeant instructor like that, but I mean, he was a smart guy. I mean, he was a senior Marine, very well trained, training us. Now, you know, their training methods are hard. I mean, they're not coddling you, but I mean, they know what they're doing. I mean, it's the best training in the world. I mean, it's not a game, it's not a joke. And, you know, we're sitting here laughing about it and telling stories like that. But then the final part of the story is after that, I kind of went in to thank him. I said, well, Platoon Sergeant, thank you for helping me. And he looked up and he goes, Barra, don't thank me. I would be remiss in my duty if I allowed you to leave here defenseless. Remiss in his duty if he allowed me to leave here defenseless. And that's the way it was. It was business.
Yeah. Don't get all warm and fuzzy on me.
Yeah, that's right. That's it, exactly. And then, you know, that's the way it was. And that's how you train somebody to fight with a bayonet.
Now, what other kinds of weapons training did you have?
Basically, it wasn't that, what they told us. We asked them that. And we said, well, how come we're not getting more of this? And they go, well, they said, you're going to be officers. Your weapon is your platoon. You're leaders. You fight with your platoon. If you're leading your platoon from the right place, and the enemy gets that close to you, there's nothing we can do that will save you except for your own instinct to survive. And, you know, they said, and if you're in the wrong place, you deserve to die.
harsh,
yeah. Oh, I'll never forget the first time the company first sergeant walked in there. His name was Lee. Went in, he was a Korean veteran. This guy walked in. He had creases on his face. I mean, his face was, I mean, he was so perfect. All he did was he walked in, pointed to his, you know, three stripes, three rockers. You know, it was a full arm puller. He says, I am the company first sergeant. Looked at him, pointed to this, Korea. That's the old Marine Corps. And, you know, he walked up and down. And I don't know how he did it, but he felt like he was talking to each one of you individually. He was talking to the group, but somehow it felt like he was right in front of you, you know. And he said, If you think I'm going to salute you just because you went to college, you're wrong. And, he, you know, and then he says, if you, and I'll be candid, he says, if you think I'm going to let you get any of my young privates killed because you fucked up, you're wrong too. He says, you're not going to get out of here and fuck up and get somebody killed.
So they only had the best NCOs training the officers.
That's right. These, every one of them was recon. Every one of them had that little eagles in the parachute on there. They were all recon. All of them were from, all of them had, he had Korea, but I mean, all of them were Vietnam. No sidewalks in Vietnam and we're in that mud. No sidewalks in, what do you think? There's no sidewalks in Vietnam. And we're in the mud, I mean, up to the ankles and stuff like that.
Now, when did you think, in your own mind, that I'm going to make it?
Not until the very end. I didn't waltz through. I mean, that's part of the reason why I left. I was not MacArthur, you know, going through at the top of my class. What they do is, as you go through, you have various, you know, they score you. You have, you know, various tests. You have peer evals. You have their evals. You have your evaluations from all your billets and stuff like that. Funny story. As they were testing me, one of the things they were testing was my confidence. So every time, you know, I made the Midas, they relieved me of command. You know, just, you know, they were trying to rattle my cage. So I was relieved. So I'm there. Well, yeah, to the point where they didn't have anything to evaluate me because they relieved me all the way through. I'll never forget the captain. I forget his name, but he was from Annapolis. Our executive officer was a captain from Annapolis. There's two kinds of commissions in the Marine Corps, reserve commission and a regular commission. All the guys that go through OCS and stuff like that, they get what they call a reserve commission. The guys that come through Annapolis or through the Navy ROTC can opt for the Marine Corps, and they have a regular commission. You can convert your reserve commission into a regular commission, maybe, if they like you and they let you do it. But the reserve commissions are at the pleasure of the president, all that other stuff. I mean, the reserve commission, they don't, you know, you put in your 2 years and you're gone. The regular commissions are the guys that are the team. You know, that's the group they want. So if you have a regular, so this guy was Annapolis regular commission, and we were going to be reserve commissions. They're looking at us, and if they like you, they'll keep you around. If not, you're gone. So he was there, and he looked at me. We were out on a field problem. And it was a little bit messed up, but it wasn't really my fault. It was just what had happened was we were out in the field and we had some stuff to do, and you know, various platoons and squads were out doing stuff, and some of these idiots got lost, so we were late. But you know, shit rolls uphill, so it's my fault. So you know, he's there and he goes, Barra, I'd relieve you of command, but I can't because I have to evaluate you. You've been relieved from every other command you had, so you got to stay. that was the motivation. So anyway, I go through. So I had all of that stuff. Well, at the end, you know, they come down to the final cut. You know, it's like the final hurdle. And if you're right on the, if you're marginal, if you're right on the line, you have to go through an evaluation, a board eval, you know. Well, we'll get to the end, and I know that I'm not scoring real high on all the tests, you know, especially because I don't have, because they've been right in my cage. So I'll never forget this. We had a last inspection, you know, one of those things like that. So we're all there. And this is where the battalion commander, Colonel Wickwire, P.A. Wickwire, Colonel, United States Marine Corps commanding. Wickwire's walking down the road, right? Big gold, you know, colonels have eagles. Well, this eagle, I don't know if they shine him up or he had an electric chair. I mean, this eagle glowed. I mean, it like filled up the whole. Well, we're going down and we're just all standing in a tent. You know, so he's doing the inspection. And do you ever see the thing on the Dirty Dozen, the movie where the guy's a joke and he walks up and down the line?
Yes.
And then he stops to talk?
Yes.
Well, Wickwire decides to stop and talk to me. Now, I know that's a setup, too, because he walks all the way down the whole thing, and then he decides to chat with me. So I'm there. So he stops. And then the major, Vitos, he's right behind him. He stops. And the captain, Crawford, he's right behind. So all three of them are there. And he stops and he wants to talk. So, he's there and he's got the, she looks at the rifle and stuff. Like, but that's not it. He's talking. He goes, how are you doing? Fine. How have your evaluations been going? Badly. Well, how badly? Well, a 6 on SATs and a marginal. And he goes, have you gotten instruction from the staff to help you along? Yes, sir. Do you think you're going to graduate? I hope so, sir. Stuff like this. And he's there and he's looking right at me. And there were guys when they were shitting in their pants. He stops. they're shaking. But I figured, what the hell? I mean, he wants to talk. And I'll never forget. He's standing right in front of me, and all I could see was that eagle. That eagle's right. I don't even know what the guy looks like because all I saw was that eagle. It's right in my right. And I think they do that on purpose too. It's right in your face. So I said, yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir. And he goes. Then he goes down the line to the next guy and he looks at the. And then I'll never forget this. The major was a vitals. He had just made major. And as he stood in front of me, squared up right in front of me, he looked me right in the eyes. I mean, more so than you're doing right now. And I looked right back at him, and I didn't blink or I didn't break. And I'm trying to think, why is he staring? Why is he? He's clearly he's looking right. I mean, he's looking into my soul. And I'm there, and I stood there, and I looked, and then he walked, and Crawford did the same thing. He stands there, and he looks, and and I stood there. But what I did was, I figure I'm not going to lie. I'm going to tell him, yes, how I do, 6 on SATs and a marginal. I mean, that's the way it was. He knows what the record is. I mean, he knew what that record was before he asked me what it was. But I'll tell him. I'll fess up in front of the whole platoon. I can't hide it. That is what it is. And I did it, and I said it. So then we go through, I have to go through the board evals. Basically what you do is they go there and they make a final decision whether they want you or not. I'll never forget this. This is one of those moments in your life you never forget. I go up there, and they're all sitting up there. And there's like 8 guys sitting up there, in front of a big long table, and you're sitting over there. And you walk in, and sit down. And I'll never forget Vitos was there. And you say, well, Beryl, what do you have to say for yourself? And I looked at him. I said, well, sir, I've been here for 9 weeks. You've been watching me. Basically 24/7. I said, I'm kind of at a loss for words. I don't know what to say. And he said, well, let me be a little more clear. What you say in the next few minutes is going to affect the rest of your military career. And I looked back and I said, well, I may not be the best candidate here, but I'm certainly not the worst, and I don't deserve to get thrown out of this program. And then it went on from there, and then they started asking me all kinds. And then there was one with Cunningham. He was a first lieutenant on the end. He was one of the other people. Cunningham goes there and says, well, Barra, did you ever think you were unjustly relieved of command? I go, yes, sir. And I gave him Harris relieved me on one of the 3-mile conditioning marches. There was nothing wrong. And I went through that, and he looked and checked it off. And obviously they were doing that. And they asked a whole bunch of other questions and stuff like that. And then I left. Then they left, and then they ultimately I made. I'll never forget again. 2 exhilarating moments. One is when on graduation day, when I marched down the parade ground, down the grinder, and there. The second one was when the guy from Annapolis called me in his office, the XO. I'll never forget what he said. He said, "Barra, we've decided to keep you at the company level. At the company level, the decision was made to keep you in the program. Because you can go all the way up to the battalion commander, it's company, stuff like that. He says, we decided at the company level, the decision was made to keep you. You have all of the qualifications to be an outstanding Marine officer. My one bit of advice to you is don't wait until the last minute before you decide to make a good impression." And I go, thank you, sir, and I got it. And that was it. And again, you talk about one of those, one of those things that make it all worthwhile. The thing that made it all worthwhile. Here was a captain, Annapolis graduate, Marine, recon, all that. He said, Barra, you have all of the qualifications, or all the attributes to be an outstanding Marine officer. My one advice to you when you get to basic school is the next thing. He says, well, don't wait until the last minute before you decide to make a good impression. I go, thank you, sir. I wasn't really trying to wait till the last minute. It just kind of happened like that. But that was it. And that was the fruition. I mean, that was the thing that I take away. I mean, that made my whole life. Up to that point, that made my whole life. That was the recognition or what I had sought. You know, all the time when I went there, and I was saying, you want to see how tough you are, you want to see if you can cut it, you know, all of the mystique about the Marine Corps, it all came down to that. And that, those few words, I mean, I wasn't in that office more than 45 seconds. I walked in, saluted, you know, he said that, saluted, got the hell out of there. I mean, it less than a minute. But that minute, up to that point in my life, that put it all together. And that's, it's all worthwhile just for that. That's why you do stuff like that. Yes. You know, the thrill of victory, the agony of defeat. Well, that was the thrill of victory. The risk is that you always have the possibility of the agony of defeat. And that's the risk you take. But, you know, sometimes you've got to roll the dice.
So at the end of the 10 weeks, then, and you had made it.
Yes.
You mentioned that there was a ceremony that they had.
Yes.
Did your family get to come?
Oh, you could, but like my family was in Chicago. Okay. And, you know, so, I mean, some people's family came, but again, you know, it was just a graduation from OCS. They actually went through. I guess there were guys there with, you know, some, what they call, legacy. They went through and they asked us to fill out, is any military people of the rank of general coming? Is any, you know, because, you know, they said, we want to know if a general's going to show up, or they said anything like that. So they were trying to get a handle on who was going to show up. Because, well, some guys, their fathers were in the Marine Corps, they were officers. And so the kids are following in their father's footsteps.
But obviously they absolutely did not get any kind of preferred treatment. Because they didn't even know that.
No, not at all. Okay. Towards the end, they said, well, okay, if you come to graduation, is anybody from the rank of, you know, and they were going down the list because they wanted to arrange the seating, you know, and stuff like that. So they started to get ahead. They wanted to see who was going to show up. In fact, we had one guy, he was from Hawaii, and his father was a colonel or something like that. So they wanted to know if he was going to show up and stuff like that. You know, so, yeah, but then the last day, what we had was a final parade, a final inspection, final parade. There was five companies, four companies of the PLC class, and one company that was commissioned right on that day. They were senior. They weren't going back for their senior year. They were already graduated at bachelor's degree, so they got commissioned that day, and then the other four companies were going back to college for their senior year, and then we would be commissioned at some other point in time.
Okay. So what came next?
Well, after I did that, I'll tell you what came next. Okay, we had just gone through 10 weeks of all this, you know, camaraderie, all for one for all. Okay, go to the airport again on a group travel ticket. I'm sitting in Reagan, you know, and there's a bunch of it. And these, you know, what they did was going back. It was even less commonality than coming out of Chicago. I mean, there were just 10 guys going back to Chicago. So somebody else had a travel ticket. So we're there, and we got to the airport about 12:30, you know, hurry up and wait. And the flight wasn't going to leave till 3. So, okay, well, we'll meet back here at like 2 o'clock or something like that. Well, somehow, there was an earlier flight with some open seats. And I had gone to look in a bookstore or something. I came back, and they're all gone. And I go, that ticket has been cashed in, and that they all went on an earlier flight. I go, okay, well, I mean, there was 10 spots on that open travel ticket. I said, obviously 8 or 9 guys went. I said, there's still got to be an open spot. I said, I'm on the 3 o'clock flight. Oh, no, that travel ticket's all at once. We traveled it all at once. And I said, well, how the hell am I going to get to Chicago? They said, we have to buy a ticket. I go, what? I said, no, that travel voucher was to be used only that one. It was a group travel voucher. The group left. You weren't in the group. So, you know, you have to buy it. So I had to buy my own ticket back to Chicago. So that's what happened there. So I got there. Fortunately, I'd gotten paid. So I had cash, you know, so I'd gotten that. So I bought my ticket, got back. So I go down, and then I go down to City Hall, and I have to petition back, you know, send an expense report back and stuff like that to get my, I think it was like $90 or something like that at the time, a ticket from Washington to Chicago. And I go, oh, great, you know, all this time we're talking about, you know, we're all together and stuff like those assholes. They wanted to pick up an hour and left me stranded in the airport. And didn't even make a provision that, hey, we got one guy left that's going to be on the 3 o'clock flight. They were just so eager to get back home that they left me there with my thumb up my ass. It's great. So then I went back to college. And at the time, Western was on quarters. Okay. So I had to finish my senior year. The OSOs came down like once a quarter on their recruiting trip. And they basically reviewed. I mean, we had to stay in shape. We had to stay out of trouble and stuff like that. So we'd come down. They'd come down once a quarter, and they'd give us the physical training test, the PT test, push-ups, sit-ups, 3-mile run. We had to do that. They had us work with the Army ROTC guys. So what we did was, when the Army ROTC guys needed stuff like they'd go out and do a field problem, let's say. And they needed somebody to, you know, play aggressor or something like that. They'd send us out there, you know, go out to let them chase you, you know, stuff like that. And then, for some reason, the Army didn't let. Anytime they fired their rifles and stuff, like, we ended up cleaning them. So let the Marines clean them. They're good at that sort of thing. So, you know, basically, I cleaned a lot of rifles for the Army ROTC program, and went out and, you know, crawled around a. Argonne Forest Preserve down in Macomb to play with them, but the Marines did come down. We had meetings once a quarter where they went through stuff. They you know just updates on what's going on and stuff like that. And they came down and looked us over. I mean, they didn't want to be just going there being drunk for 10 weeks or 10 months, something like that. I mean, they came down and looked, and they were just starting. I don't even know if it's still down there, a PLC club. Again, the Marine Corps, and especially the Officer Corps, is very fraternal. So what they did was they started a club. They called it the PLC Club. And it was like the Marine version of a fraternity. And we were the charter members. So I was one of the guys that had my hand on the sword and took the oath and all that stuff. When the club first started at Western, I haven't been back to Western in years. I assume the club's still in existence. I don't know how they're recruiting now. And I don't even know if they're still recruiting out of Western. So I don't know that. But at the time, they had started a PLC club down there. And what it was exclusively for Marine officer candidates. And it was a group where they wanted us to stick together, or they wanted us to be together. So we'd work out together, or we'd go running and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But it was very informal. It wasn't like we had formal classes or anything.
Okay. And then after you finished your four quarters at Western, what happened next?
I was late. I was supposed to graduate in May or June of 73, and I was a couple quarters short. So and at that time I wasn't in the aviation program, which was the original reason why I wanted to go in there. Now I had accomplished what I wanted to accomplish as far as graduating from OCS. I had signed the paper saying that if a commission's tendered me, I will accept it. If not, I'll go in as an enlisted. I mean, I had signed up. But then I'm figuring, well, you know, again, knowing that my rank and the thing, I said, what's in store for me? I said, probably a rifle platoon in Okinawa, crawling through them. I said, I'm not going to the embassy, and I'm not going on the ship or anything like that. I said, I'm going to the mud. So I'm thinking, well, I said, well, what the hell? I'll apply to graduate school. And again, I wasn't really the best student in the world, but I figured I'll try. So I applied to graduate school at Western. And I got in on probation, I think I had a 2.8, which, was okay, but you ain't getting into grad school if you don't have at least a 3.0. Even so, I applied to Western's grad school, and the dean at the time in the business college, I had a bachelor's of business. His philosophy was, well, if we give you a bachelor's degree from our undergraduate program, how can we say you're not qualified to be in our graduate program? So he said, we're not sure, with a 2.8, what your academic prowess is. So we'll let you come in on probation. I said, okay, fine. I said, I've been taking, almost graduate-level courses, 400-level courses. And I said, so I figure, okay, well, here I have two options. I can go in the Marine Corps with the commission, or I can go to grad school. So I got, and it was a very, very difficult. You know, you talk about the decisions you lose sleep over. Well, this is one you lose sleep over. I said, well, I'm not going to be a pilot. Well, it's another story. I have bad eyes and bad ears, too. I'll tell you the story how I got in the infantry. But so I'm looking. I said, and then I decided I'm going to go to grad school. So I resigned. They call it discharge on request. Fortunately, at the time, the Marine Corps was cutting back. In 73, it was the post-Vietnam era. So they're cutting back. And officer billets, you know, first of all, it's very, very esprit de corps gung-ho in the Marine Corps. If you don't want to be there, they don't want you. It's no iffy, wishy-washy kind of stuff. You're a Marine or you're not a Marine. You know, hit the road if you don't like it. So I never took any money from them except the pay when I was on active duty. I never took tuition reimbursements, flying lessons, book money, anything like that. I mean, maybe a couple of beers, you know, that was about it. So when I resigned, they weren't happy about it. You know, in fact, they said, well, you know, think about it. And then, I'll tell you two funny stories. They accepted my resignation. So I went to grad school and I resigned in the beginning of 73, 74, something like that. So basically my Marine experience was 10 weeks at OCS, a little bit of reserve time in what would be like an ROTC program at Western, and that was it. Funny story. I told you my dad was in the Navy. Well, we had several things, even when we were here, that they had social functions. So in other words, they'd have dinners, like when Heinz used to have... If you go down First Avenue in Roosevelt, on the right-hand side of the road, there used to be, just a little bit north of Miller's Meadow, there used to be some houses back there. Those were the officers' houses for the officers that were at Heinz. There were some very nice houses back there, a little like a little subdivision. the officers were living there. So the captain, they invited us over for dinner and stuff. So I brought my dad. Now, my dad hates Marines. You know, he was in the Navy for 10 years. So, but he met him and stuff like that, blah, 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 blah. So when I resigned, you know, the officer, they didn't really want me to resign, you know. So he called my dad. And he goes, well, maybe you could talk him out. Maybe you could influence him, you know, because we don't want to see him leave the program and stuff like that. Maybe you could. Well, my dad hates Marines. he's been waiting for this. I don't really want to tell you exactly what my dad said, you know, being a salty sailor. You know, he had some choice language about the Marine officer that called him on the phone and asked him to persuade me to stay in the Marine Corps. but that didn't work. So, but that was that. But anyway, the second story was, you know, how I got in the infantry. I have a whole range of sound that I don't hear. So, I mean, I had a middle ear infection when I was a little kid and stuff like that. But anyway, so you go there and you take the physical. This is way back in the beginning. You go there and take the physical. And you have to take a hearing test. I don't know if you ever took a military physical. They go in. I call it the horse physical. They count your fingers and your toes and all that stuff. But anyway, you go there, you put the earphones on, and you have a little button there, and you press it when you hear the sound. You know, here's hearing test. There's a movie called Wind Talkers with Nicolas Cage. He scammed the hearing test just like I did. On that, if you watch that movie and see the way he scammed the hearing test, I did it substantially the same way. When I didn't have a hot-looking nurse flashing me the signals, I'm there and I'm taking the, and what it would be is you press the button, and they're back when they even used to have three, you know, those index cards like for the computer cards, the rectangular cards. They'd have, so you get squiggly lines, and so I looked at my card, and I look at everybody else's card, they have squiggly lines, so you press the button and it makes a squiggly line, or goes up and down and stuff like that. I'm looking at mine, and there's squiggly lines, a whole big flat part, and then squiggly lines. And then I'm looking, well, I don't know what. So they called me aside, well, Mr. Barry, you're going to have to take the hearing test again. The audiologist wants to reevaluate it. So I'm thinking to myself, well, shit. I need them squiggly lines all over that car. So I mean, well, I can't hear it. So what I did was, I counted the beeps that I did hear. I counted the distance between the beeps, like 1001, 1002, 1003, 1001, 1002, 1000. So when I stopped hearing, it's exact kind of 1001, 1000. I pressed it. So come back, get the car. They got squiggly lines on it. The audiologist looks at it. He goes, well, geez, you must have had a bad headset in the other test. I go, yeah, must have. That's how I passed the hearing test. And then I saw that movie just this last few years, Nicolas Cage in the movie Windtalkers. Okay. He basically did the same thing, only he had a nurse flashing him the signals, you know, stuff like that. But yeah, same thing. It's like, yes. So now it's a real intellectual question. I wonder how many other people scammed the hearing test to get in the Marine Corps just like that. But those are my two stories.
Well, you've been pretty clear about how your training in the Marine Corps has influenced your life.
Oh, a tremendous amount. I'll tell you, you know, it's almost, I'd almost be willing to say it's probably something everybody should do. But, you know, I guess everybody can't do it, or everybody wouldn't be motivated to do it, or everybody wouldn't want to do it. But as far as the quality of the training, the way it influences your life, it's just invaluable. One thing just as an aside, just as an observation, I think one of the things that's wrong with this country right now is there's not enough commonality. So in other words, there's not enough, if not a shared experience, or at least a shared base that just, I mean, differences are fine, and diversity is fine, but it helps if you have some sort of common base to start from. And I think the one good thing about the military is that it gives everybody a common, at least some sort of common denominator. Like I told you when I was a kid, you know, all the guys that had been in World War II and the American Legion pickings being like Taste of Chicago or something like that. Well, all those guys, I mean, there was everything from doctors and lawyers to construction workers. But they were all in the American Legion. They were all together. At least, you know, superficially, as far as, oh yeah, were you in the Army, you were in the Navy, stuff like that. And I think that's one of the things that's missing, or that's one of the things we have to overcome as a country right now, is the fact that, you know, diversity is fine, but you need at least a basis, some sort of basis of commonality, some sort of basis of shared experience, or shared values, or shared something, shared conversation. And I think when everybody starts going at each other like this, I mean, and there's no basis, you know, you say, why isn't there any basis for compromise? Well, because there's no basis, you know, who is that guy? Or, you know, why should I compromise with him? You know, he's an idiot. There's no togetherness. And I think, you know, one of the best things about the military, I mean, there's good and bad about the military, and God knows I didn't go in for very much of it. But the one thing it does bring people together. I mean, you all sleeping in the same room, you're all wearing the same clothes, you're all eating the same food, you have a shared experience. I mean, even if one guy ends up being a lawyer or a judge and the other guy ends up being a criminal, I mean, at least, you know, at one point in your lives you were together. And I think as a country, you know, that's one of the things you probably should kind of maybe strive for. So you say everybody should go in the service, or a universal draft like Israel or something like that. You know, you say, well, that's not us. But by the same token, you need some sort of, maybe everybody should go to summer camp together. I don't know. But something like that, where you bring some commonality in. But that's just my opinion.
Any other last thoughts you'd like to share with us?
No, that pretty much covers my, like I said, my experience was somewhat inconspicuous. I mean, very inconspicuous. I mean, I went through OCS for a lot of personal reasons. I mean, I certainly haven't made any great contribution to the country or to the Marine Corps or anything like that. I'm just a guy that went through. I'm very satisfied that I did it. I like to think that, you know, if they needed me, yeah, I would have gone. But I mean, at the time, Vietnam was winding down. There was no war. In fact, they were cutting back. I mean, there were guys fighting to keep their jobs. I mean, there were second lieutenants that were being on reserve commissions that weren't getting their regular commissions and were being rotated out. So, you know, the fact of me going in and doing whatever I could have done, I like to think that maybe I left a spot open for somebody who really wanted it much more than I did.
Okay, well, thanks so much for sharing your memories with us today.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Great stories.